The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Present your case to our experts by calling in between 12:30 and 1 on Sundays. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now your host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Good afternoon and welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. And happy holidays, happy Easter, happy Passover. This healthcare clinic and the Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, which, by the way, is now the largest women's healthcare symposium in the USA, are both brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create a community-based, interactive, and dynamic healthcare safety net to make you a lay expert for your personal medical problems, leading to a better partnership with your existing doctor, with more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable health and emergency care. Our fourth annual symposium was March 21st, just a couple of weeks ago. We had 1,800 participants with over 5,000 hours of education in just one day with or by 21 physicians volunteering their time on a Saturday, speaking plain English on 21 different medical topics, answering your questions, and helping provide a breakthrough for you. Last week, I shared with you some of the comments we received, some of the very exciting, very thankful comments we received on the symposium, and here's another one I received in the mail just a few days ago. Dear Dr. Maskin and Focus on Females, we want to thank you for the wonderful, informative Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium. We heard from so many in the health field. The information we heard will certainly help us maintain a healthy lifestyle. Great job. The exhibit area was educational. Thanks for the health screening. Again, we were reminded a healthy lifestyle, exercise, and a proper diet are essential for our population. And that's from Kathy and her family in St. Petersburg. Thank you, Kathy, very much. We do enjoy receiving these very positive and comments, and we encourage everybody to share with us their thoughts, comments, questions, recommendations for our future symposium, symposia, as well as this radio healthcare show. In fact, I will also share, during the symposium, at least two or three women came up to me asking if it's possible we can add a topic to our radio show, and that being celiac disease, also known as gluten-sensitive enteropathy. And I will say at this point in time that we will add a show. I'm going to try to get it on sometime this summer, so pay attention, if you would, to our website, focusonfemales.com. On the radio healthcare page, you can get to that page on the bottom left-hand corner of the homepage on the website. And look, when you reach the radio healthcare page, just scroll down on the calendar of topics and look for when we will be doing the show on celiac disease. But we will cover that this summer. Now, today's clinic is on another topic in gastroenterology. It is on gastroesophageal reflux disease, also known as GERD. And with me, I'm very excited and pleased to have an expert on gastroesophageal reflux disease, and that is Dr. Jürgen Nord. Dr. Nord is a native of Germany, received his medical degree magna cum laude from the J.W. Goethe University of Frankfurt, Germany. In 1965, he was awarded a Fulbright scholarship. He completed his residency in internal medicine at Indiana University Medical Center in Indianapolis and his fellowship in gastroenterology at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. In 1973, he moved to the University of South Florida College of Medicine here in Tampa, where he is professor of medicine in the Division of the Digestive Diseases and Nutrition, which he has had directed from 1990 to 2000. Dr. Nord is a past president of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, the Florida Gastroenterologic Society, and the Florida Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. He serves on the editorial boards of several scientific journals. Dr. Nord has special interest in postgraduate education and has directed or co-directed 60 postgraduate courses. He has lectured at more than 630 local, regional, national, and international courses and scientific symposia. He has co-edited 3 books, manuals, and more than 160 publications are to his credit. Dr. Nord has been honored in the Best Doctors in America since 1996, and in 1998 he received the Laureate Award of the Florida Chapter of the American College of Physicians. The American College of Gastroenterology has awarded him mastership in 2005. And Jürgen, is again my pleasure and honor that you join us here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start at the beginning, and that is, would you share with our listeners just what is GERD?
Yes. GERD, or gastroesophageal reflux disease, is an abnormal condition where gastric contents are refluxed in a retrograde fashion into our swallowing tube. Normally, the swallowing tube, or what we call the esophagus, is a one-way street, so to speak. And in GERD, abnormal gastric contents containing acid and bile are refluxed, and the contents are very acidic. The pH is in the neighborhood of about 1, that's comparable to battery acid in your car, so to speak. So while the stomach is protected against acid, the esophagus is not, and that can cause significant symptoms and significant damage over time.
Well, let's answer the question, or just address the issue of just why is it so important. I mean, some patients, I understand, may be have relatively fewer symptoms than others. So long term, what can this this chronic irritation and inflammation do to the lower esophagus, for example?
Well, if the esophagus is exposed to acid, it can cause erosions, meaning damage of the lining, and as the lining then heals, scars will form, and as a result, patients can result in a stricture or a narrowing, which could impede the passage of food. So all of a sudden, food might get stuck, and that can be a serious problem. Other complications, and we can maybe talk about that later, could be replacement with a different lining, which ultimately even could lead to cancer. So it can be very mild, it could be moderate, and sometimes it can be a very serious problem.
Okay, and because of the potential for a serious problem, whether it be cancer or other, as you said, stricture or narrowing, with difficulty perhaps getting your food properly moved into the stomach, this is something that's important for everyone to understand. Certainly if they have symptoms of it, they need to be aware of it, educate themselves, and receive evaluation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. And while the patient who has just typical GERD, which is manifested by acid regurgitation or heartburn but no alarm symptoms, these patients can be managed just with medication. But if patients have alarm symptoms, and let me just mention a few of those, Steve. Mm-hmm. For instance, if the patient has an unexplained anemia, if the patient has weight loss, if the patient has pain with swallowing, or if food is getting stuck, and most commonly it is more solid food like a sandwich or meat or a piece of apple as compared to soft food and liquids, then these patients should be evaluated.
And they should be evaluated because this is potentially suggestive of more advanced disease.
That is correct. It's suggestive of more severe disease, of more advanced disease, and of complicated disease. And there are special treatments available to not only initially evaluate, but then manage these patients.
Okay. So if I'd like to review, for example, the risk factors of GERD, which I guess dovetails into what causes GERD.
Mm-hmm. Let me go over them, and there are many. Initially, we thought it was only a weakness of the sphincter muscle in the lower esophagus. And at that time, you know, you would have kind of a common chamber that liquids are flowing forth and back, especially at night. And actually, most of the severe gastroesophageal reflux occurs at night when you lie flat. So that was one thought. But now we have learned that there are actually other mechanisms which play a role as well. And that sphincter muscle in many patients is normal, meaning it has a normal resting pressure, but it relaxes inappropriately quite frequently. And that can then lead to reflux. Other problems are that in about a third of patients, the stomach does not contract appropriately and there is delayed emptying of the stomach. And that can be a problem. Other problems are ineffective esophageal peristalsis, the waves that kind of clear the esophagus, the same wave that kind of propels a food bolus down into the stomach, may be ineffective, again, in about a third of patients. And especially at night when you sleep, and you might remember you wake up in the morning, your mouth is dry, there is decreased saliva production. And saliva, not only as a liquid, helps to clear, but it also has some bicarbonate, which is a buffer to help to neutralize the acid. So there are multiple mechanisms. Some patients have a hiatal hernia. Many patients are aware of a hiatal hernia, and large hiatal hernias can trap acid above the diaphragm in the chest, so to speak. And again, this would be a cofactor for gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Let's review some of these. Now, for example, you mentioned that in some cases the lower esophageal sphincter, I guess that the muscle or surrounding or part of the lower esophagus that when it's contracting is able to keep the gastric contents in the stomach?
Correct.
Now, you mentioned that sometimes it tends to relax. Now, I remember from medical school, I graduated forever ago in 1984, and obviously there's new information on these topics since, but is there a normal variation in the tone of that muscle? I remember that what you eat, your diet, for example, can impact the tone, but is there a normal tendency or variation or diurnal or daily curve in the tone of that muscle on its own?
Well, in and by itself, it stays at a resting pressure to keep things out of the esophagus, so to speak. When you swallow, in anticipation of that swallow, a signal is sent down and then it relaxes and opens up and allows a food bolus to pass through. It's the same mechanism that is also used to vent the stomach. For instance, you have a carbonated beverage and you have some burping, some eructations. Again, that sphincter muscle will relax. And there is a sensor in the stomach that kind of sends a signal there. And what happens in patients with gastroesophageal reflux disease, that sensor, so to speak, that thermostat, if you wish, is set at a very low threshold. And small stimuli can relax it. And then inappropriately, this sphincter relaxes and allows acid to slush back into the esophagus.
Okay. And let's go over some of the dietary foods,
okay,
for example, and some of my references that I will bring up are from an article in New England Journal of Medicine last year, October of last year, on gastroesophageal reflux disease. And I'll mention these, and if you were, you know, others to add or make comments, please do so.
Okay.
Okay, dietary avoidance, things to avoid, are foods that are acidic or otherwise irritative, and they mention citrus fruits, tomatoes, onions, carbonated beverages, and spicy foods.
Yes, those certainly, if the esophagus is irritated, can irritate it more. Think you cut your finger and you squeeze a lemon, you know, it hurts. And it's kind of the same mechanism.
And they say that the foods that can cause gastric reflux include fatty or fried foods, coffee, tea, caffeinated beverages, chocolate, and mint.
All agreed. And the fatty foods are especially important because our diet today, especially in Western countries, is too high in fat. And fat is difficult to digest, and therefore the stomach, which is very smart, senses that, and it slows down the emptying of the stomach. Therefore, the stomach stays fuller for a longer period of time, and therefore has the ability to reflux. The other food substances that you mentioned, like chocolate and mint and caffeine and coffee, all of these things which for many people make life worth living, these substances have a direct effect on the lower esophageal sphincter. So if you think for a minute, you know, you go out to a restaurant, maybe a steakhouse, and it's late at night and you have a juicy steak and the juiciness is due to the fat, and you have a dessert, maybe a chocolate cake, and on the way out you pick up a couple of mints, and then you wonder, you know, why when you lie down you're then suffering from significant reflux.
Beautiful. Yeah, and I remember years ago when we used to go out with, when I was a kid, the whole family got together, grandma and grandpa and mom and dad and my sister and so forth. And that's exactly what we did. That was, and I remember grandma reaching for the mints on the way out. Absolutely. So this is like a multi-tiered attack on the lower esophagus and stomach.
Correct.
And the other things that they mentioned in this article that are recommendations to avoid include smoking, smoking cessation, weight reduction for some patients who are considered overweight. They reference the, you know, the BMI. Reduction in alcohol consumption, nighttime symptoms. Well, we'll go over that. Let's just start with smoking cessation and weight reduction.
Yes, smoking certainly can have a significant effect. Again, it can stimulate acid secretion. It can have an effect on the lower esophageal sphincter. But most importantly is weight. And as all of us are well aware, overweight is really an epidemic and a major healthcare problem, not only in this country, but in many other Western countries as well. And again, in the New England Journal of Medicine, maybe a couple of years ago, was a study that indicated as our body mass index increases, even within the normal range, and normal is from about 20 to 25, gastroesophageal reflux goes up, and it goes up significantly and exponentially as you go then into the overweight and into the obese category. So if patients want to do something which is non-medical, so to speak, without medication, just to try to reduce and hopefully normalize body weight would be would have a major impact on gastroesophageal reflux.
Excellent. Alcohol consumption, do you recommend that, or can someone have a glass of wine with dinner?
Oh, yes. I mean, there is obviously some evidence that alcohol in small amounts might even be beneficial. And so the negative effect of alcohol is very, very small. And especially as we maybe later get into some pharmacotherapy of gastroesophageal reflux disease, patients should really be able to live a quote-unquote normal lifestyle, meaning if they enjoy a glass of wine or a cocktail, that should not be an issue.
Yeah, so there are other things like the weight, for example, which if you manage properly, you may be able to enjoy the cocktail and so forth.
Yes, and even maybe get rid of the medication that you may have been placed on.
Good point. Now, they also mentioned that it could be helpful to avoid eating within 3 hours before bedtime, and to elevate the head of the bed.
Yes.
What is, you agree with those?
Yes. Number one, you know, as I mentioned the story about the steakhouse, for instance, you know, you come home late, your stomach is full, and you lie down right away. The stomach is kind of a cupboard, so to speak, where food is stored, and then it's emptied at a slow rate to allow for the digestion in the small intestine. And therefore, if your stomach is full, maybe you have overeaten, then you're more prone to reflux. And I mentioned at the outset when we talked about the etiology of gastroesophageal reflux disease that indeed most of the severe reflux happens at night, and therefore if you elevate the head of the bed, and that's one of the few lifestyle changes which have been found to be beneficial. So if you elevate the head of the bed maybe about 30% or so, that can help significantly because fluid does not run a pill. Now, many times I get patients and they say, well, you know, I sleep now on three pillows as compared to one pillow. Well, I mean, look at the pillows in the morning. They're all scrunched up and they're flat. And what really needs to be done, that you put some blocks under the bed, or maybe you invest in a foam wedge that you put under the mattress at about 30 degrees. If it's too high, you kind of slide off, or your partner slides off. And so as physicians, we usually spend a good bit of time to talk about these simple things so that patients truly understand what we mean by elevating the head of the bed.
Right. And you can get those little blocks, right? You can, I know Bed Bath
yes.
& Beyond has those blocks.
Yeah, you can... 6 inches about. Mm-hmm. If you have a water bed, that's a problem because that will not work. And so a water bed would not be a good sleeping device for patients with mm-hmm. GERD.
And how about consuming smaller meals, smaller, more frequent meals?
That would be good in many, many different ways. You know, it would go a long way to help us with our weight problems, but to eat maybe a snack in between and not really make the main meal late in the evening. If your main meal is in the evening when you come home and the entire family sits around the table, then again, it should be maybe a more modest meal.
And how about the patient who tries to squeeze into that, you know, that 32-inch waist pair of slacks rather than rather than perhaps buying the 34-inch.
Yes, of course, you know, looking trendy, the very tight jeans with a belt around it, absolutely. And so you have to think about it, that things go the way of the least resistance. And so if you really squeeze that waist, it has to go somewhere. And if the weakest spot is at the gastroesophageal junction upwards, then it goes upwards. So, again, some comfort and comfortable fitting clothes are more appropriate.
Okay, and just before the break here, I was again the same article in New England Journal of Medicine estimates references as an estimated 20% of adults in the United States have this problem with GERD, and of course, if my math is correct, we're talking about almost 70 million people.
Absolutely, and that's probably an underestimate. The American Gastroenterological Association did a survey across the country and targeted the various cities, and actually targeted Tampa, Florida here as well. And we were actually one of the kind of GERD centers, so there was
wow.
a significant number above the national norm just in our part of the country. So, yes, it is almost an epidemic. And because of obesity and many other factors, our diet being too fat, too rich, this is getting worse.
Okay. And when we come back from the break, we will talk about therapy. We talked already about dietary and lifestyle changes that can be made. We're going to talk about medication and possible surgery for gastroesophageal reflux disease with Dr. Jürgen Nord on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We'll be right back.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Call now in Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. More in a few moments.
Hello, Nathan Jensen here from Paragon Risk Management. You've heard for months now about our insurance agency, what types of insurance we write, and how we treat our clients. Whether it's homeowners, personal auto, or commercial insurance, you get our full attention when you call.
Say, Nathan, did you tell them yet about all the top-rated carriers we work with who are committed to providing coverage for folks in Florida?
Yeah, I was just about to.
Rich Jensen again from Paragon Risk Management. Since we are independent agents, we can be your one resource for every type of insurance, personal or commercial.
Right. Insurance needs don't always fit in a box. So why would you use an agent who's limited by only one company's policies?
Or get a policy online without ever talking to a real person.
So what are you waiting for?
Call us today at 1-866-599-1199. That's 1-866-599-1199.
Or online at ParagonRisk.com.
Paragon Risk Management.
Insurance protection with confidence.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic...
Have you checked your calendar? It's tax time.
I have a message for you from the government.
But that really means it's feeding time for those money-hungry lawmakers in Congress.
Hungry, hungry hippo!
They're taking your money on April 15th. But guess what? They want more.
They are all money-grabbing con artists.
They're looking for new taxes on energy, healthcare, small business. Now more than ever, we're watching where your money is going. Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
Are you ready to stop the bleeding in your financial portfolio? Hi, I'm Steve Skegis, inviting you to tune in every Saturday afternoon at 2 as my co-host Michael Serio and I discuss simple truths about your money. We'll discuss current economic news and events and how you can protect your financial future with safe, effective retirement solutions. Remember, it's your money. So join me, Steve Skegis.
With SRN News, I'm Michael Harrington in Washington. Christians celebrating Easter all around the globe, and something special to celebrate up in Vermont, the hometown of that U.S. sea captain, Richard Phillips, who had been taken hostage by Somali pirates. We have word at this hour from U.S. intelligence officials that the sea captain has been set free. Don't know much more than that. We will let you know when we do, but good news for Richard Phillips and his family. He is free today. President Barack Obama and his family have celebrated Easter Sunday at St. John's Church here in Washington. The Episcopal Church is across from the White House. It's been popular with presidents. President Lincoln went there during the Civil War for a private moment to pray. The day after John F. Kennedy's assassination, the new president, Lyndon Johnson, prayed there as well. Negotiations for the release of Thailand's exiled and ousted prime minister, is calling for negotiations as thousands of protesters swarm the capital. A demonstrator says they will overturn the government. This is SRN.
It's that time of year again. Time to donate your boat or car. The friendly folks at Boat and Car Angel can guarantee you the highest tax deduction allowed. And your donation will help change the lives of children around the world. Visit Boat and Car Angel on the web and get an instant donation receipt, free pickup, and four-night luxury vacation. Call 1-800-CAR-ANGEL or online at boatangel.com. Help save a child. Donate your boat or car.
Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 18 years and is board certified, fellowship trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and the American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2008 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please, visit drmaskin.com. And if you've not found relief for your painful red, dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We're tackling gastroesophageal reflux disease. And Jürgen, we left off and at the point where we're ready to talk about some pharmaceuticals. I guess the classic pharmaceutical therapy for reflux disease is the cimetidine type drugs, the H2 blockers, but there's also the proton pump inhibitors.
That's correct. And actually for milder disease, some patients self-medicate with antacids. That is kind of like a quick flash in the pan. It doesn't work very well long term. For mild disease, I think any of the H2 blockers are appropriate, like cimetidine, ranitidine, and others. The cornerstone, I think, at the present time is a class of drugs called proton pump inhibitors. Those are the most effective acid blockers, and those would be the omeprazole, the esomeprazole, pantoprazole, and these kind of drugs. And while they are more expensive, they are the most cost-effective because they have a longer duration of action and really block acid more effectively than any other.
A couple of questions. What is the difference in the mechanism of action between the histamine receptor antagonists and the proton pump inhibitors?
Good question, Steve. There are three pathways that ultimately lead to the formation of acid in the stomach, and the H2 receptor antagonists block one of those pathways, which is mediated by histamine. So they block a precursor, so to speak. The ultimate pump that pumps the acid into the stomach, called the proton pump, is effectively blocked by the proton pump inhibitors. So that's the last pathway where everything is blocked, and they block that pump irreversibly until the body makes a new one. And for that reason, it's a longer acting and therefore more effective drug.
I see. So it basically covers all bases, no matter
Correct. What
mechanism or what secretory cells involved. The proton pump is the final pathway. Therefore, you block that, you're blocking all acid secretion.
Absolutely.
How long does it take before new proton pumps are synthesized?
It takes about, they are always continuously pumps synthesized, but an average is about 12 to 18 hours. And therefore, these medications work almost 24 hours, not 24 hours, but almost.
And can you give us some examples of the drug names that people may recognize when they hear them?
That's yes, yes. One is called Prilosec, okay. One is called Prevacid, one is called Nexium, and one is called Acefex. And recently a new one came out as well, which is called Cabidex.
Okay. All right. And I guess, was it Protonix is another one?
Yes, okay. Protonix is another one. And okay. Let me make maybe one brief comment, Steve. It's very important that these medications are taken correctly, meaning you need to take them on an empty stomach about 30 to 40 minutes before the meal, because then the medication is in the bloodstream. When you eat and the meal is stimulating the pumps, and the medication attaches itself to the activated pump, to the pump which is activated by food. So if you take it during the meal or after meal, or if you take it at bedtime, that would be the incorrect way of doing it.
I see. And is there a preferable meal for which you take it half hour before?
It should be the first meal of the day, okay. And in general that should be breakfast, but some people say I don't take any breakfast. I have maybe, you know, a light snack or an early lunch. Then it should be prior to that first meal of the day.
Okay, excellent. Okay, online one is Anne from Tampa. Anne, you're on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic. We're tackling gastroesophageal reflux disease today. Welcome. Anne, are you there?
Oh, this is Pam.
I'm sorry, Pam. Okay. Pam, welcome. You have a question for Dr. Nord.
Yes. I was wondering, I was told a long time ago that I had asthma and GERD. And I was wondering the relationship between the two of them and if there was a relationship.
Yeah, thank you. That's an excellent question. And the short answer is yes. And that relates to what we call the extraintestinal manifestation of gastroesophageal reflux disease. There are many. Asthma is one and a very important one. And there are two proposed mechanisms. One is that there are sensors in the distal esophagus which are stimulated by acid which can cause bronchospasm and asthma. The other one is that you have reflux which goes to the proximal esophagus and then gets into the voice box and into the upper airway. And then because the airway is so much more sensitive to acid as compared to the esophagus, it causes then again by reflex mechanism and direct stimulation bronchospasm. So the implication is that some patients who have the non-allergenic, non-childhood, meaning adult onset asthma, could benefit from aggressive treatment of their gastroesophageal reflux disease. And by aggressive, I mean hydrogen ion acid, so to speak, has to be blocked. So these patients have to be on higher doses of medications for a longer period of time. And while the classic acid reflux responds within 5 to 7 days, these patients might really have to be on it for 2 to 3 months before a significant benefit is seen.
And this means going right to the proton pump inhibitors.
Correct. You would go directly to a proton pump inhibitor, and you would take twice a day, once before breakfast, once before dinner time, as compared to the somewhat mild and maybe somewhat less effective drugs like the H2 blockers.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just said non-allergenic asthma. I also have allergies, and I get allergy shots.
Yeah, now the question is, do the allergies contribute or are part of the asthma? There are ways to test if acid reflux plays a role, and there are some sophisticated tests that we can do to see, but it may be difficult to tease out to what degree acid reflux and to what degree allergy plays a role in your particular case.
Pam, do you have persistent symptoms with your, let me back up, are you getting heartburn? The symptoms of reflux right now?
No, I've never had heartburn. Mm-hmm. I've had throat clearing, a lot of throat clearing, a lot of heaviness in the throat, like a pulling sensation.
Has that gotten better with treatment of your allergies?
Over time, yes. But during allergy season, it's really bad.
Would that not suggest that it may be predominantly an allergic basis?
Yeah, it might very well be because patients where indeed the proton pump or other medications help are those patients who not only have asthma but have clinically clear evidence of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And those where there may be quote-unquote silent reflux, where the symptoms are very minimal, if non-existent, most of the medications or all the medications really, according to some very recent study, actually the one that you recently cited last week in the English Journal of Medicine, do not work.
So it sounds like you're doing well at the present time, but if things worsen, then you may want to revisit that. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pam. Sorry we got your name wrong.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Also on the line is Barbara from Reddington Shores. Welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Hi, Barbara. You have a question on gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Yes, I would like to know, do you recommend, and how often do you recommend an endoscopy?
Thank you for that question. How often do we recommend an endoscopy? If patients are below the age of 50 and have typical reflux without any alarm symptoms, which I mentioned earlier in the show, then I think we go directly to therapy, and that's all that is needed. If patients have the onset after the age of 50, or if there are alarm symptoms like pain with swallowing, food getting stuck, or maybe anemia, weight loss, these kind of things, then an endoscopy should be done. And in patients who have been diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus, which is a complication of gastroesophageal reflux disease as a premalignant condition, then regular monitoring with an endoscopy is done. So the bottom line is not everybody needs an endoscopy. It's a select group of patients.
And how often?
How often? If it is for just establishing the diagnosis, or let's say you have been placed on medication, you don't respond appropriately, we wonder, do we have the correct diagnosis, then a one-time endoscopy is appropriate. And there is a term called once-in-a-lifetime endoscopy. That's for patients to make sure that there is no Barrett's, that there are no other complications. If there are complications, then it's tailored according to the patient.
I see.
Is this for yourself you're considering?
Yes, this is for myself.
And do you have known gastroesophageal reflux disease?
Yes, I do.
And how long have you had it for?
Oh, probably like 10 years now.
And what kind of therapy have you been on so far?
They've had me on several. Prilosec seems to be working the best. But if I eat something acidy or like a banana or something, then I get it back again, and I vomit. I actually vomit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might suggest, you know, maybe a complication. There may be inflammation in the lower esophagus to narrow it. There may be a stricture. There may be other matters. And in that situation, I certainly would feel better if I have an endoscopy to see, you know, what is going on. Because the endoscopy, as compared to an X-ray or other studies, would be the most sensitive because it's diagnostic. We can do biopsies. We take photographs. And in some situations, we can do therapy at the same time, meaning if there's a narrowing, we can stretch it open.
Barbara, have you had an endoscopy already?
I've had one, but it's like been 10 years.
Yeah, in a situation like that, usually the intervals are about 5 years or so. So it might be worthwhile to discuss it with your physician.
Okay. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Very good questions. Very good questions. And okay, let's go back to treatment. We discussed pharmaceutical treatment, surgery. When, Jürgen, is surgery considered?
Surgery, which is called Nissen fundoplication, which is a surgical tightening of the lower esophagus, is quite frequently done in patients who don't respond appropriately to acid-blocking medications. Now, acid-blocking medications are in general very effective, meaning anywhere between 85 to 95% of patients do very well. And studies have shown that if you take the treatment failures, that surgery isn't that good either. The best responses are in those patients who respond well to a proton pump inhibitor, to Prilosec, Prevacid, Esomeprazole, Nexium, any of those medications. The surgery many times has been suggested as a quote-unquote cure. Said, you know, why would you like to take medications for the rest of your life? We do a surgery and you're fixed once and for all. And that sounds too good to be true and actually is because we don't have studies that go much beyond 10 years. Furthermore, we have now some long-term studies, a VA cooperative study, that has shown us that after about 10 years, indeed 60% of patients are back on medication. Half of those are back on a proton pump inhibitor. And furthermore, there are some issues with surgery as well. Number one, it's highly variable and dependent on the experience of the surgeon. There's a significant learning curve, so you want to find the best, most experienced surgeon that you can find. It's plastic surgery. Number two, we know that patients lose the ability to belch, for instance, the ability to vomit. Many patients, since they cannot belch, become very gassy, full and bloated. And so while it might solve the GERD problem in one way, it creates some problems in the other way.
So for you, for example, you would only consider surgery if, number one, it was your reflux disease responded to a proton pump inhibitor, but for one reason or another, you couldn't handle the side effect of that proton pump inhibitor.
Yeah, or the individual, you know, said, I am sick and tired of taking a pill every morning. I would like to consider an alternative. Mm-hmm. And with proper education, I think I would certainly consider that. And here, especially at USF, we have some superb surgeons who do this extremely well, and the outcomes are very good.
And why do you think that that the majority of patients that do well in surgery are the same patients that do pretty good with pharmaceuticals, and that we the balance, the 15% or so that don't respond to pharmaceuticals, we're just not being able to help these people?
Yeah, that's a tough group of patients, and sometimes you wonder, you know, do we have the diagnosis right? These are more patients who don't have erosions in the esophagus, so when you look down there, it kind of looks normal. It doesn't mean they don't have reflux, but they have a normal lining. There is also a component called functional gastroesophageal reflux disease, where there are some functional overlays, and again, you know, it's maybe a more heterogeneous group, and that's why the response is not as good.
All right, we'll be right back with more on gastroesophageal reflux disease. And when we do come back, we'll be talking about the what's called the extraesophageal symptoms of this disease. You'll see what I mean when we come right back with Back in a Flash.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Call now in Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. More in a few moments.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 4th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702.
Confused about dry eye? Not getting answers as to why your eyes are so red and painful and your blurry vision that gets a little better with a good blink? Now you can learn all about dry eye, the causes, treatments, and home remedies from the number one best-selling consumer book on dry eye problems, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome by Dr. Stephen Maskin. Published by Yale University Press, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome has been selected as a 2008 Best Book of the Year by the Association of American University Presses and a 2007 Best Consumer Health Book by Library Journal. Find answers for your dry eye. Go to your bookstore and pick up a copy of Reversing Dry Eye. You'll be glad you did.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back. Thus far, we've talked about patients with known gastroesophageal reflux disease. They have heartburn. They have significant symptoms that can easily be traced to reflux disease. But how about for those of you that are listening as a general audience, just trying to increase your general knowledge of medicine, there's also a category of patients with syndromes from reflux disease that don't have the heartburn portion of it, such as chronic cough or laryngitis or chronic clearing of your throat, hoarseness, asthma was brought up by one of the callers. And so these are syndromes that one may not think about reflux disease but can be caused by reflux disease. And I imagine, Jürgen, you see a fair number of these patients.
Yes, absolutely. And you are absolutely correct that there are many of these syndromes. I might like to add to it, for instance, erosion of the dental enamel, for instance, or what's called non-cardiac chest pain, where patients have pain which sounds and feels like pain coming from the heart, but it's actually due to reflux. So there are many of those, and initially you don't think about gastroesophageal reflux disease as a cause of these symptoms.
And how does a person diagnose that? So you're out there, you have a chronic cough, and what should people be thinking about? When do you start thinking that, gee, maybe this what's causing this chronic cough or my hoarseness is something that's not been identified? Should you start thinking about whether these symptoms or hoarseness, chronic cough, is worse in the morning when you get up or in the middle of the night? Start thinking about a relationship between lying flat and the appearance of these symptoms, or are there other ways to do that?
Yes, I think that's a good point that you made, that indeed in the morning when patients wake up, these symptoms are very significant and they clear their throat repeatedly, and then by maybe 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, things feel better, and their voice, which might be very hoarse, changes to a degree as well. Many times the clue for that is that indeed, if you look carefully and if you take a very detailed history, that there are indeed some signs and symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And if that's the case, then indeed patients respond to treatment of the gastroesophageal reflux disease, and then the extraesophageal manifestations improve as well.
Okay, so so in your experience, if you evaluate these patients getting a history, you can tease out that there may be some symptoms of heartburn, or maybe they wouldn't describe it as heartburn. They would maybe use other terms to describe that, but you can elicit a history of such symptoms?
Yes, for instance, that these symptoms may have gotten worse after a meal, after a heavy meal, or like you mentioned, early in the morning when there was significant reflux during the night. If you have patients where, in spite of very detailed histories, you cannot tease out anything, then reflux, even if it is present, probably doesn't play a major role, and those patients would not improve with treatment of their reflux disease.
Have you had an experience where a patient would come in with these, would turn out to be extraesophageal syndromes, although perhaps it wasn't clear initially, but they were obese, and simply just to do a trial of trying to lose weight to see if those extraesophageal symptoms would improve?
Yeah, I have not had that experience, and the simple reason for that is that weight loss, if it occurs, is usually very gradual, and as you know, it's one of the most difficult things to achieve, and even patients who are successful many times gain their weight back. But I certainly have had patients or patients who came from the ENT physician where significant inflammatory changes were seen in the throat, sometimes even ulcers, where it's kind of clear that acid reflux and irritation might play a role. These patients have improved, but like I said, they require a higher dose over a longer period of time, and their coughing got better, their voice got better, and sometimes they have this globus sensation as if a little golf ball is sitting back in their throat. All of that has improved, but it takes a long period of time.
And in that same article in the New England Journal, they mentioned four other proposed associations with reflux disease. I'd like to get your feedback. One is recurrent otitis media or middle ear infection.
Yes.
And then sinusitis, pharyngitis, and pulmonary fibrosis or scarring in the lungs.
Yes, the lung changes, even bronchiectasis and others have been implicated. Sometimes it's difficult to prove that, but as you mentioned, you know, this spectrum is quite wide, and therefore, at the present time, our understanding has expanded, and gastroesophageal reflux clearly goes beyond the esophagus as a target organ.
Okay, we're in our last couple of minutes, and Jürgen, I'd like to ask you if there's any message or messages that you'd like to leave with our listeners at this time.
Yes, Steve. Number one, the question frequently comes up, you know, should these patients be treated lifelong? Can I get off the medication? And I try to draw the analogy to hypertension and diabetes. It's kind of a lifelong medication. Now, if you're on high doses, it doesn't mean you have to be on it. You can probably step your medication down, and we look for kind of control of symptoms. The other point that I want to make, that these medications are about as safe as they possibly can, and they have been studied extensively, and so patients should stay on them and not be worried. These drugs don't lose their overall efficacy over time, and as I said, are some of the safest classes of drugs that we have.
And not only that, as you mentioned, if in certain cases, like the extraesophageal symptoms, you can double the dosage, and again, you have that safety margin.
Absolutely.
With the use of these.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And about maybe 25-30% of patients require a twice a day as compared to once a day medication.
All right. At this time, I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jürgen Nord, for providing his expertise on gastroesophageal reflux disease. And I'll remind everybody listening that next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, we will tackle digital mammography, breast MRI, and other women's imaging with guest expert Dr. Ted Cardosa on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Have a great week and look forward to speaking with you next Sunday. Bye-bye.